This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
They'd rather pay over $10 billion in private contracts as opposed to paying the people that actually educate and service our children.
In Los Angeles, more than 70,000 education workers are set to strike. We hear from members of the SEIU 99 bargaining team.
The whole world has to isolate this rogue, apartheid, genocidal maniac, serial-killing, pathologically lying state. Isolate it, shame anyone who goes there. Academics, celebrities, politicians, and they've been exposed for what they are.
Investigative journalist Abby Martin reflects on the visceral reality of Israeli society and the collapse of its state propaganda.
That meeting was the product of years and years and years grooming of Donald Trump himself by this foreign apartheid entity. It was essentially a coup, and this war is the result of a coup.
Gray Zone editor Max Blumenthal traces Trump and his A-team's deep links to Zionism. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Paulina Vasilyev. A major confrontation is taking place in Los Angeles this week, where more than 70,000 education workers are set to strike. This includes SEIU 99, UTLA, Teamsters, and other unions. This strike comes in the midst of a strike wave taking place in schools in San Francisco, Richmond, and Sacramento. Gilbert Feliciano and Janae Tyler are on the bargaining committee of SEIU Local 99, which represents 30,000 service workers. They spoke to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about school privatization via charters, the conditions that the students and staff face, as well as ICE terror attacks on the community and in the schools.
Why don't we talk first about why workers in Los Angeles, education workers, the conditions they face that have led them to take this position that they may have to go out on strike again and fight for their conditions and benefits and what the issues are?
Primarily, what we have here is the district trying to maximize their profits on the backs of workers. I mean, simply put, I mean, their staffing levels are to the point that they are stretching literally every unit in the district. Now, whether you talk about the buildings and grounds, whether you talk about special ed, a lot of these third party companies come in to provide services. And part of the problem is that that increases the workload for the average staff member, the average member of the local. Above that, the corruption is out of control. You know, the amount of kickbacks that appear to be shifting left and right. You see the power of some of these interests. Right now, the district is actively trying to put an AI program into an MOU. Okay, so we're getting attacked on every single facet, you know, and that's just the beginning of it.
And the drive to privatize, outsource, contract out charter schools. Janae, why don't you talk about that issue? Because it's not just a Los Angeles issue. It's part of Project 2025 to privatize all of public education. And this is part of it.
So let's take it back to 2007 when this effort first started in LAUSD. So this isn't anything new. I tell people all the time, when you're in a fight with someone, you know, people say, oh, it's a winner and a loser. But a lot of time the loser learns and they learn how to come back and fight better. And so what we have now with the co-location and the overrunning of charters on our school campuses is a direct result of the impact of us as public school parents and public school staff winning our right to save our schools through what was called Public School Choice Point One. And that was when they wanted to come in and just buy our campuses. They allowed private industry to put bids in for our schools without any plan on how they were going to educate the neighborhood children or what schools our kids would go to. You know, so this started back way then. I won't, you know, for the sake of time, get too far deep into the weeds on that. However, on the backside of Prop 39 is how we ended up with all of these co-locations. And since then, there have been numerous attempts to disguise this effort in many, many ways. So going back maybe about three, almost 4 years ago, they tried to bring something to LAUSD called student-centered funding formula. With student-centered funding formula, on the surface, sounds like something that any parent would love. It sounds like a great plan for school, but it's literally the voucher system. And it's the voucher system that decimated the school districts in Chicago, in Denver, in Louisiana, in New Jersey. And some of those districts were able to catch it enough in time enough to salvage and then rebuild. However, it's literally what has 90% of the schools in Chicago that were once public schools closed down. And those schools that they chose, the area that they chose to do this in was a predominantly all Black and brown neighborhoods. This effort that has pushed into LAUSD has been a long fight. And what they do now is, it used to be a double shark attack, but now it's coming from all different sides, down to the fact that one of our board members was put in their position by privatizers spending $4 million to put him in that seat to expand the charter school efforts, while those of us that work in the Reclaim Our Schools LA Coalition, which is Students Deserve, ACE, LANE, and UTLA, have been working for years, and one specific thing, even with the teacher's bargaining contract, building out the community schools model, fighting for public education, and making sure that we convert our schools into institutions that fully educate the whole child, regardless of the disposition of the child, and make our schools the go-to for parents to not want to choose something else for their children. Co-location has turned schools like Westchester into almost like Eastside High. And people say, well, what has happened to Great Westchester? Well, Great Westchester has four charter schools occupying its campus, which is actually a direct violation of Prop 39. Even with our charter commission in LAUSD, there's no real checks and balances other than when these charters get ready to go forth and present to the district on whether to be reapproved or not. But when you have seven board members and only two of the board members are actively fighting for public school children and actively fighting against all of these attacks from privatizers, it's an uphill battle. And so that's why it's taking community parents and even student leader activists in high school and even a few in middle school to work alongside our educators and us as classified employees as well, to make sure that we continue to do the best that we can to save our schools. You know, so this is not just political. This is more financial than anything, even down to the fact that LAUSD is sitting on $5.03 billion at this point in its reserves. But then they still don't want to pay us fair wages. They still don't want to bring us up to even what's considered a livable wage in California. They'd rather pay over $10 billion in private contracts as opposed to paying the people that actually educate and service our children.
Section 39 was supported by Reed Hastings, who owns Netflix.
Exactly.
And the Charter School, California Charter School Association.
Charter School Association.
Yes.
Supported by billionaires. And they, marketing plan, they spent hundreds of millions of dollars marketing charter schools, saying they want to give choice. I mean, when you talk about co-location, what does that mean in like a high school to have three or four charters in one high school?
All the Title I dollars from the students, that absolute supplemental services, it sucked out then the funding for those extra staff members, even down to our buildings and grounds people even having clean bathrooms. You know, people think of that as like the bare minimum. You know, we want kids to be able to be educated in a classroom where they don't have to worry about whether rats are going to come through the walls, you know, things like that. And so I don't even know how we can say that we're really caring for children, or how they can say that they're really caring for children, when at the end of the day, they're fattening their coffers, you know, performing. One of the things I had said to Gilbert was, and I think I said it out loud, even in our bargaining meeting yesterday, was that, you know, it's about solvency. LAUSD is the second largest school district in America, which makes it a large company. but it wants to perform as a corporation. And education dollars were meant to be spent. They're our tax dollars that are supposed to go to schools to serve students, which also means making sure we have fair contracts.
And a lot of these billionaires too, like Reed Hastings, that's like you said, was pushing that. Eli Broad, which was also pushing that. At the end of the day, what these billionaires want, okay, we have to be very clear. They want to take public education, public funds, and privatize them. They want to take private, they want to take public funds meant for our children to create a business model by which choice is sold, and there's always a revenue. There's always a business plan at the end. And that's the problem. And in fact, it gets even crazier than that, because as they sell choice to parents through these, the voucherization of education, what that does is, yes, it sells to the parents that they could take their child to, you know, this school or that school. But at the same time, what that does is it opens up the door for what? For private schools, right, for academies that normally get paid for by wealthy, affluent parents that if they want to take their child to an academy, they want to take them to Andover, wherever it is, they should come out of pocket because it is a private institution, a private education. And what they're actually doing is they're taking these public fund vouchers that are meant for public education, and now they're paying these private institutions. So basically, they're stealing private public funds and transferring them into private hands for profit.
That sounds like that's called embezzlement to me. You know, I used to manage financial institutions. So, you know, there is a term for that. That is a federal crime called embezzlement. So,
and this battle's been going on, you know, for over a decade. I remember when Diane Ravitch, you know, former Secretary of Education, really got on the, I would say, the people's side and started trying to dismantle the charter system, but there's too much interest. There's too much.
One of the issues, and this is also have to do with the funding in California. California is the richest state in the United States, has over 200 billionaires. Yet Governor Newsom now says he's not even provide the full funding, which is guaranteed under a law that was passed in California. They're closing schools. Unions are negotiating contracts. And then following the contracts, they say, we're going to close all these schools.
And remember, as these students populate the charter schools, that's actively taking population from the public school. Okay, that's how the funding gets allocated, based on student attendance. You know, so we have basically, yep, we have a stratification that's continuing. And going back on the strike situation, over all these years, it's the pressure's been building up, primarily the system continually abusing people to the point that a lot of times it makes it easy for the boss, the district, to split workers up, split different managers and, you know, associates, split unions, you know, create divisions between them. And this, I could tell you, this particular strike roadmap is much more potent than the one we took 3 years ago. Every union that's active, from ALA, which is represents the principals, administrators, UTLA, which represents teachers, SEIU, which represents buildings and grounds, community reps, special ed assistants, cafeteria workers, truck drivers, delivery, etc. All of these workers, the working class, is actually coming together. And we've actually said, LAUSD, you have the money, quit playing, and you're not going to divide us. If any of us decides to accept our a tentative agreement, that does not mean that they're going to separate or break this movement. No, we already said, no matter what, everybody has to get their contract, and that will officially stop this strike from happening on Tuesday. Other than that, if the teachers get their contract or their tentative agreement and we don't, they're still going to go out with us. If we get it and they don't, we are still going to go out and support them. So this right here is honestly something unprecedented in LA labor history, as far as I'm aware of. And I guess the next question is, how can we, after this hopeful victory, right, after this mobilization of the proletariat, how can we channel this energy into a movement, though, that actually gives us a political option? Because right now we have no option. It's either extreme right wing capitalism or blue light capitalism. But at the end, the worker is left behind, and both parties are basically shaking their hands in back rooms. So that's the follow up on that.
The institution of ICE, or the bringing in of this fascist terrorist force into Los Angeles, what effect did that have in the school?
I have a whole different perspective. I have that perspective, and I also have the perspective of the fact that my cousin was the first person murdered by ICE. It was not Rene Good. Keith Porter Jr. was my cousin, and he was murdered by ICE on New Year's Eve in the comfort of his own apartment complex by someone who was an off-duty ICE agent that has a history of child abuse, racism, homophobia, and was on whatever kind of drugs and alcohol out of his mind that hunted my cousin down in the building and killed him that night. So we want to be clear that that devastation alone should have been eye-opening for people. A Rene Good and an Alex Preddy should have been eye-opening for the American public, who thought that this, you know, in California especially, oh, it has nothing to do with us. You know, and so when we talk about the effect that it's had in our schools, as a parent and family center director, as the person that is the direct link between the parents, the community, and the school, I've had a family that stopped buying groceries last March to save up enough money for 3 months to self-deport back to Venezuela with a 16-year-old daughter and a 14-year-old daughter. I will say, because this is a public interview, I have to watch how I say things. But as a mother and as a person that works with students, I'm not used to always saying it in the way that people would consider PC. So I'm going to do the best that I can. These are two beautiful young ladies who have already developed past puberty. And the plan that that family has taken was to self-deport back to Venezuela with no papers and no ID, just in case they were stopped by hostiles, and then send the two girls on a train by themselves from Venezuela to Colombia to stay with some people who told the father or gave him a guarantee of being able to receive them safely and for them to have a better life. We are talking about two beautiful teenage girls traveling alone with no ID, no paperwork, no school records, in an environment where we know that people are sex trafficked, human trafficked. And these are the things that parents are willing to brave because they're scared of Trump and ICE. I had a student who has never heard his father cry, and he was actually in my office. It's one of my leaders in Students Deserve. I'm also the parent and family organizer for Students Deserve, and I hold down our school chapter. And his father was hiding in a bathroom stall, calling his son, not knowing whether it would be the last time that he heard his voice, let alone saw him, to tell him that he loved him because ICE had just raided his job. We have families now, we have moved where we used to, you know, real family engagement is bringing families onto campus, engaging with them, involving them in our practices, our decision-making, giving them professional development to help remove the barriers to their children's education. And we've moved to almost exclusively Zoom with certain hybrid situations to keep parents safe. I watched an elementary school graduation that ICE raided as our superintendent was saying that we're going to keep our kids safe and we're going to protect our schools. ICE pulled up on an elementary school graduation. I believe it was a kindergarten graduation at that. And those parents ran one way and those babies ran and clinged to their teacher's legs, screaming and crying. So when we're talking about the effect that ICE is having on our school, it's torture. It's mental and emotional torture. When you see 5-year-olds being detained, when you see parents at school drop-offs being dragged out of their car, even though they're legal American citizens, but because they have brown skin. When you watch a woman that's in a wheelchair be dragged out and knocked down from her wheelchair and detained. And then for them to say, oh, we're sorry, 2 days after the fact and releasing her. Our families are more than frightened. They are terrified. We fought to remove school police from our campuses to end a lot of the criminalization and trauma that had been caused by them. And now, not only do they have the fear of ICE getting back and forth to school, but ICE activity around our campuses. And the district thought that it would be a bright idea to put at least two school police officers back in the front of our campuses, believing that they could be the front line of any type of protection for us. And that has not been the case. What has happened is it has made those students revisit that trauma that they finally felt at peace from. And every week, at least, I have a school that's supposed to be phone free, but I get text messages from students like, excuse me, miss, I don't know what to do. This officer is standing here in the quad staring at me. I'm just trying to eat my lunch. They still have their guns on them. It is affecting how our administrators maneuver. It's affecting how they deal with even us as staff members. The best way that I can sum this up is terror. I don't want to belabor it, but families are terrorized. Schools are confused on how to respond, even though there is a district policy in place. We were supposed to create sanctuary teams at each school. Through the efforts of UTLA, getting that approved, and they haven't had any training, nor do they know how to actually establish their sanctuary teams at most of our schools, even though they have advocates like me at least almost each of our high schools, because our organization is in at least 30 of our high schools. You have confused admin, you have teachers and staff members in limbo. And they run to the one or two people that they think might have information, like a Gilbert or like myself. And it's overwhelming because not only do we have to deal with our own emotions, but we have to deal with their trauma. I've been accused of being everything except for just a black girl from Compton. So even for me, it's like, do I need to have my ID, my driver's license, my passport, and my birth certificate? Like how they did the citizens of Minnesota, in order to drive out of their homes and pass the stop sign, they had to show an identification card, So it's confusing, it's frustrating. And so the best that I can do is to try to, now I've shifted from the district mandatory workshops to self-care, mental health, mindfulness, trying to help families at least find a way to decompress from it all, just to have to get up and do it again the next day, and giving them some type of tools to even be able to comfort their students. In regards to our students, it has unnerved them because they see how even those that the majority are citizens, they see how American citizens are being treated. My coworker walks to work every day. She just became a US citizen 7 months ago, right before all of this stuff really kicked up out here. And I'm still terrified for her every day. I'm always like, Martha, get home safely. Text us, let us know you made it. She lets us know when she's leaving the house on her way home, on her way to work, because I'm the one that gets there the earliest, things like that. And so it puts us in uncertain times, and it's not a good feeling. And then when we do, as humans, see what they are doing to us, to see the way that they have raided our schools, the way that they have shot our children with rubber bullets for exercising their right. We have a young man right now from the last protest where the students were downtown at City Hall who has now lost an eye because he was shot with a rubber bullet. And they weren't even being agitators. They weren't unruly. I was actually proud of those students. They held themselves well. They spoke well. They were able to articulate their needs and the affairs of their hearts, and they were met with state-sanctioned violence. It's a mess.
And I just want to piggyback on that, that's just the students. Don't forget, right, teachers getting dragged out of their class because they aren't citizens, or, you know what I mean? That I myself, I'm a citizen, and I'm not going to front like, oh, I feel like I'm 100% safe. I literally have my passport in my car at all times now, which is something that would be crazy
I'm
to me.
You. Because before, as black before? As you know that I am, wait, Gilbert, as black as you know that I am, that's why I said that, because people, a lot of times, and I know my hair is wrapped up now, and you know, when I come to work, I'm in hoodies and stuff, but I dress like a human when I'm not at work, you know, and so people have stopped me since I was like 13 or 14 years old, just randomly on the street, like, oh my gosh, you look so exotic. Where are you from? Are you Belizean? Are you Honduran? Even in my medical records, I was having a medical procedure and I just happened to look up at the machine at the nurse's station, and the hospital that I have been, the medical group that I have been a member of since I was a kid, had changed my ethnicity in the system that said Afro-Caribbean Black, African-American, blackety black, Negro colored hued, melanated.
You stupid.
Celebrate Juneteenth. Black and American black, you know, so it's like, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Gilbert.
Nah, yeah, 100%. Nah, I just wanted to throw that in there because, yeah, we ain't safe. I mean, we've never been safe.
Those were the voices of Gilbert Feliciano and Janae Tyler, who are on the bargaining committee of Los Angeles SEIU 99 at LA Unified School District, which represents 30,000 service workers. They will likely be going on strike on April 14th, when they expect to have 70,000 education workers on the streets. That was Aretha Franklin with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. Think. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Paulina Vasiliev. Next, we play an excerpt from an interview that Gray Zone editor Max Blumenthal gave to Professor Glenn Deason on his April 11th podcast. Blumenthal traces the deep links that Trump and his family, as well as his A-team tier of advisors, have to various Israeli, American, and even Russian Zionists. The American ruling class formed a bipartisan strategic partnership, he says, before and after Israel's founding in 1948. It is now strained by growing domestic opposition to the ongoing war against Iran's Islamic Republic.
According to the New York Times, part of the problem with, or one of the reasons for Trump engaging in this disastrous war was that the Israelis apparently had a key role in convincing him. Now, you, not just in the past, you have made this very strong argument that the Israeli influence in the U.S. is quite powerful, to the extent that you essentially have Israeli agents in the White House. I was wondering, how intrusive is this influence?
Well, it's all-encompassing, and it defines Donald Trump's entire career. And, you know, even if you go back to Fred Trump, gifting land to the Chabad Lubavitch cult, which has a very pronounced presence in Donald Trump's inner circle. It goes back to his father's time. Donald Trump's entire world is surrounded. I mean, his world, his political world is defined by pro-Israel billionaires who are his counterparts coming up in New York. Charles Kushner, for example, who is also a very corrupt real estate baron. Howard Lutnick was someone who was in Trump's world as the CEO of Cantor Fitzgerald and someone who is also closely connected to Jeffrey Epstein. Steve Witkoff was Trump's longtime golfing buddy, major real estate baron who's very much a part, along with his sons, of the Zionist political world and the Zionist movement. And so when Donald Trump was running for president, however, he wasn't fully locked and loaded with the Likud mindset. And you can see that in his first speech, which I always come back to the Republican Jewish Coalition, which is effectively run by the Adelsons, was run by the Adelsons. They have their annual convention at the Sands Casino, which is owned by the late casino baron Sheldon Adelson. And Donald Trump appeared there, I think it was 2015 or 2016. And he made some comments that were unacceptable and said, "You guys are, you know, all in real estate. You know, I know you guys. We need to make a deal. We need to make a deal between the Israelis and Palestinians." He was already thinking, "I'm going to get a Nobel Peace Prize and I'm going to solve the world's most intractable conflict because I know all the people that are on Israel's side and it should be easy to move them." And they called him an anti-Semite for saying that. And they said, you know, he's playing on stereotypes that Jews are all involved in real estate and we're all slumlords. But the real problem was that Donald Trump said, "You're going to make a deal. We will have a Palestinian state." That was the problem, because that's what the Adelsons have been working against. That's what the RJC was working against. So the next thing you know, Donald Trump appears on Capitol Hill. It was the first time I've ever seen him in person. And it was an anti-Iran deal rally, a rally to cancel Obama's signature JCPOA. Ted Cruz was there, you know, Tel Aviv Ted. He's always been a huge recipient of AIPAC money. His office is basically run by Israelis. I'm not being glib when I say that. Like, an Israeli operative is his main legislative aide. But no one cared that Ted Cruz was there. You could see who was going to win, who was going to be president by being at this rally, which was clearly sponsored by Adelson or some Israel lobby forces that wanted to cancel the Iran deal. And it was Donald Trump. As soon as he gets there, people just converge on this field in front of the U.S. Capitol. And Donald Trump is like far and away the front runner. And, you know, you had all these pundits, mainstream pundits, saying Trump will never become president. He's never going to win out of this primary. You know, the Clintons had this Pied Piper strategy to elevate Trump because they thought he'd be the easiest to defeat. But it was at that point when he made this bargain to shatter the Iran deal, the JCPOA, which suggested that there was a deeper bargain to actually go to war with Iran. But first he had to set the stage for the war, that Donald Trump was going to be the front runner. He was going to get hundreds of millions of dollars from the Adelsons. And then other, what I would call Israel first billionaires, would supplement that support. And in the American system, that counts for a whole lot. Pretty much, I mean, the presidential campaign is really a campaign for who can raise more money. Paul Singer started to donate to Donald Trump. This was someone, remember, Paul Singer was the original donor to the Steele dossier, which was created to discredit Trump and paint him as a Russian asset. Paul Singer was actually originally a never Trumper. He was a neoconservative who was sponsoring candidates like Marco Rubio, because one of the things was Paul Singer has a gay son. And so he believed in the right of men to marry other men in the United States. And, you know, Donald Trump was seen as too conservative and too close to the Christian right. Paul Singer eventually came around and said, you know, what matters more is we have a war with Iran and Donald Trump will do what I want. So Donald Trump brought all of these figures on board by 2016. And while he was promising this war on the deep state, he was adopting figures like John Bolton into his cabinet because he would see him every night on Fox News. Mike Pompeo, arch Christian Zionist. He sidelined. Steve Bannon was quickly sidelined, someone who believed in the America First agenda. There are still voices in Trump's ear, like Tucker Carlson in the first term, who were influential and may have actually stopped the war with Iran. But you could clearly see Donald Trump moving towards the ultimate goal, suggesting there had always been this bargain behind the curtains to wage war with Iran. That's why he assassinated Qasem Soleimani, the Iranian major general who is the second most important figure in Iran, something guaranteed to set the stage for retaliation and bring the United States into an escalation trap with Iran. And that assassination was the result of pressure from Benjamin Netanyahu, who was working through the then CIA director, Mike Pompeo, to push Trump to retaliate for a series of skirmishes in Iraq with the popular mobilization units and the, you know, the Axis of Resistance, specifically around the U.S. embassy in Baghdad, and then killing Soleimani. And then when Trump came back into office, the relationship with the Adelsons was even more pronounced, more intense. And I think many people were so angry, including myself, were very angry at Biden and Blinken and the Democrats for enabling, for supporting the Gaza genocide, which opened the door for the ultimate prize for the Israel lobby, which was the war on Iran. And the personnel that surrounded Trump coming back into office for the second, for his second term, were even more pro-Israel than during the first term. There was no Steve Bannon or anything to offset the influence of these Israel-first Likudnik elements. You had Mike Waltz, who was initially supposed to be the national security chief. Mike Waltz is one of the Israel lobby's favorite pet projects on the Republican side. His entire career had been funded by the Israel lobby. You can look at someone like Mike Lawler in Congress as following in Mike Waltz's footsteps, and you can see the same kind of rhetoric there. They never stray from the Likudnik Netanyahu line. You had Rubio, of course, who Trump attacked in 2015 for being too close to Adelson. There's actually a Trump tweet slamming Rubio as a tool of Sheldon Adelson before Trump became that. Rubio also, as I mentioned before, major recipient of Paul Singer's money. Then you have Susie Wiles, the chief of staff, you know, filling the shoes of Steve Bannon, who's now on the outside, slamming Trump for being too close to Israel. Susie Wiles worked on Benjamin Netanyahu's 2020 campaign. This was not known to the American public when Trump brought her in. It was just known that she was this super lobbyist. Pam Bondi, the attorney general, was actually Qatar's main lobbyist in the United States. She was getting over $100,000 a month from Qatar, but she has proven to be completely malleable and, you know, holds secret meetings with Miriam Adelson all the time, who tells her, we have to criminalize speech on behalf of Israel. Who am I missing? Department of Defense, Pete Hegseth, went to Israel on a private, or not a private tour, on a very public tour with a settlement organization, an organization that actually physically displaces Palestinians from their homes in East Jerusalem called Ateret Kohanim, as well as Arutz Sheva, which is the main pro-settler TV online network, and gave a speech endorsing the concept of the Third Temple, which means the destruction of the Al-Aqsa compound. Pete Hegseth took the most extreme line possible in order to advance through the ranks, the extreme line possible on Israel. I'm probably missing someone, but you can clearly see, just to wrap up, you know, my survey of Trump's personnel and his funders, you can see how this played out in the Situation Room when Trump decided to go to war on Iran. I'm not talking about the February 11th meeting that you mentioned, Glenn, in your question, but you're just, because this is something we can see. Anyone watching this can look up the photos of the Situation Room and how it was divided. Donald Trump was in Mar-a-Lago when he went to war on Iran, and he was surrounded by Susie Wiles, Marco Rubio, Pete Hegseth, and I think there was one other figure who I might be forgetting. And that was the pro-Israel A-team, all the people who had been basically installed by Israel. And then Team B was actually at the White House without Trump, J.D. Vance, Tulsi Gabbard, and one other, those who are more likely to dissent from attacking Iran, who had no influence whatsoever on the policy. And these were figures, John Ratcliffe, that's the other one who is on A-Team. John Ratcliffe is another figure who is in Congress, who is supported by AIPAC throughout his entire career, who is identified in leaked audio that I obtained from a private off-the-record AIPAC session back in 2024, identified as one of the helpers for AIPAC on the inside of Donald Trump's national security team by AIPAC CEO, Elliot Brand. So Ratcliffe was there. And then you have the secret February 11th meeting, Glenn, that you mentioned that the New York Times revealed. We all knew something like this was taking place because Netanyahu was in town at that time. Highways were being shut down. He was given presidential level security. And then he storms into a Situation Room meeting, which is highly unusual for any foreign leader. And he sits at the head of the table while Trump sits to the side. And he dictates to Trump and begins fear-mongering and tells Trump Iran will have a nuclear weapon within a week. It has a delivery mechanism to attack Europe. It will soon be able to attack the United States. You must strike Iran now. And behind him on a live stream telecast is the Mossad director, David Barnea, who had been constantly briefing John Ratcliffe. And Trump fell into line. He knew what to do. And all of his team, though, the A-team that had been cultivated by Israel, also including CENTCOM chief Dan Kane, from the Pentagon brass, who was never a fan of this war, they all started murmuring to themselves, this war is insane. What Netanyahu is saying is bogus. Like, even Ratcliffe said, this is ridiculous. Marco Rubio called it BS. But what did none of them dare to do? Tell Trump how they felt. They're all a bunch of yes men. And they knew that if they expressed real reservations about this war and got in the way, they could be in serious trouble. They may not continue to rise through the ranks. Marco Rubio wants to run for president. So they just got out of the way and let it happen. But that's what the New York Times isn't telling you is what I've just been explaining for the last 5 or 10 minutes. I don't know how long I've been going for, which is that meeting was the product of years and years and years of cultivation, manipulation, grooming, threats, rewards, carrots and sticks from Israel and its cutouts in the United States for the very figures that surround Trump, and grooming of Donald Trump himself by this foreign apartheid entity. It was essentially a coup, and this war is the result of a coup.
That was Gray Zone editor Max Blumenthal speaking to Professor Glenn Deason on his April 11th podcast.
They didn't offer us their oil that we took from them before. When it was clear how we recoil, when they preferred to fight a war. They called our bluff, and so we must. So there were no good ideas to float. Complete obliteration was the next move in the game. Bomb a massive ancient nation and do it in freedom's name. We've come to turn the page, move history along, bomb them back to the stone.
David Rovics, performed by AI Tsuno, bomb them back to the Stone Age. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Polina Vasiliev. Next, we hear from investigative journalist Abby Martin, creator of The Empire Files, who reflects on the visceral reality of Israeli society and the collapse of its state propaganda. Since her 2016 trip to the region, Martin has warned that the writing was on the wall for the current humanitarian catastrophe. She describes a society in the grip of full-throated fascism, where genocidal rhetoric has moved from the fringes to the mainstream.
The whole world has to isolate this rogue, apartheid, genocidal, maniac, serial-killing, pathologically lying state. Isolate it, shame anyone who goes there. Academics, celebrities, politicians, and they've been exposed for what they are. And Zionism's on its last leg. It only exists by the weight of its propaganda, and that propaganda's collapsed entirely. The world sees Israel for what it is, and it can't last for long in its current state. You cannot expect change in a society this far gone. It is full-throated fascist. And that's why they act the way they do, with full, total impunity, because they have no humanity left. This is a society so far gone with protection of a military empire, with hatred in their hearts. And we're seeing essentially the Fourth Reich today, marching forward, and there's no allied forces coming to save us. The Israeli Knesset just passed a law allowing the execution of Palestinian prisoners, but not Israelis. This is the true face of apartheid Israel. But this is nothing new. I saw this firsthand when I was in Israel back in 2016. Full-throated fascism.
You can't deal with these people. There's no need to try. There's no need to talk to them.
There's only one way, like, I would carpet bomb them.
You would carpet bomb them?
It's the only way you could deal with it.
I didn't realize this. I didn't realize how viscerally, grotesquely genocidal Israelis were, how openly fascist they would be to anyone.
Jews shouldn't marry Arabs.
Shouldn't marry Arabs. Why do you feel strongly about that?
Because Jews is a special nation that God gave it to the Jews. We don't want the Arabs to be here.
They knew that they were on camera. That's what's so alarming to me, too. I wasn't trying to hide. I wasn't doing gotcha journalism. I was going up with a camera and saying, generally, what do you think about the situation?
I think Israelis have to take over and they have to kick them away.
I was so horrified and alarmed at the genocidal rhetoric that was being espoused. Every single person, for every generation, every walk of life, they wanted ethnic cleansing. They said we should nuke them. One little girl laughing, we should kill all Arabs. Kill all Arabs.
We need to kill the Arabs.
It shows you the impunity back then, the arrogance to just assume. This is what you guys think too, right? You're an American, you agree with me. You guys have been doing the same thing. This is who we are. We're proud racists. We're proudly fascist. I felt like I was walking into Berlin in 1932. I really felt absolutely disgusted. I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. I mean, just walking a couple steps and as white as I am, are you Arab? Are you Arab? And I'm like, what? I'm an American. Oh, good. We can talk about Arabs then. We can talk about how much we hate Palestinians. I saw the writing on the wall back then. I saw that there's no hope from within Israeli society. I went to rallies where they were calling to kick all the refugees out. You know, these were things that we're told Israel's a safe haven for Holocaust survivors, for genocide survivors. Well, why are all the African refugees put out in the middle of the Negev desert into a concentration camp? Why don't they want any African refugees there? They tokenize Ethiopian refugees, but then they make them take Depo-Provera birth control because they don't want them to reproduce. This is the nature of Israeli society. It's an ethno-state, and it's built on supremacy and hate because that's what Zionism is.
How many civilians have been killed in Gaza, from what you know?
Who gives a sh**?
Okay, but don't you feel like, for example, children?
Children grow up to be Arabs.
You have to continue to expel. You have to continue to kill to keep that artificial majority in place.
If you gave me a button to just erase Gaza, every single living being in Gaza would no longer be living tomorrow. I would press it in a second. I would press it right now. Give me that button and press it right now.
There you go.
And I think most Israelis would.
During the Gaza genocide, to see people just proclaim out in the open the genocidal incitement.
It's an entire nation
out there that is responsible.
It was heinous and horrifying, but finally people saw Israel for what it is. It's all been exposed. They're not hiding anymore. Israel's propaganda is not working anymore because for the first time, Palestinians have been able to just show us the unvarnished truth of the reality that they endure on a daily basis. We see the settler terrorism. We see the people getting mowed down for doing nothing. We see the crimes every single day. You cannot hide genocide from us. So the propaganda has become cartoonish.
I'm very puzzled by the constant concern which the world is showing for the Palestinian people and is actually showing for these horrible, inhuman animals.
It's inverted just everything that we know to be true. Black is white, up is down. It's the most moral army in the world. We're a benevolent empire spreading human rights and democracy. Who the hell believes this anymore? So it's become silly. It's become absurd.
The Israelis today saying that Hamas use Palestinians as human shields, do they?
Killing the victims, then blaming the victims for killing themselves. I mean, what is this logic?
They infantilize us. They treat us like children.
This is a genocide happening in front of our eyes.
We have, that word, as you know, incredibly emotive. And the Israelis, as you know, will be saying that they are targeting Hamas only.
It's become so obvious that we're being dictated to, that our reality is curated by tech overlords who are profiting off the infrastructure of genocide, of the surveillance of our lives. All of these things are interconnected. So the propaganda doesn't work anymore. It's too infantilizing and stupid.
One day after describing it as a tragic mishap, Israel has now claimed a deadly double strike on a Gaza hospital was prompted by the discovery of a Hamas camera.
A Hamas camera is why they blow up journalists at a hospital? Because they have a camera that was belonged to Hamas? I mean, it just makes corporate media journalists and establishment journalists look like buffoons, doesn't it? For towing this absurd propaganda that's so hollowed out and childlike. They should be ashamed of themselves.
We have some really disturbing new information out of Israel. The Israeli Prime Minister's spokesman just confirmed babies and toddlers were found with their heads decapitated.
There's no excuse whatsoever. They are complicit in this. But you see Israel buying up media outlets.
We have to fight with the weapons that apply to the battlefields in which we're engaged. And the most important ones are the social media. And the most important purchase that is going on right now is class. TikTok. TikTok, number one.
Do you see Israeli billionaires trying to tamp down on the narrative? They're desperate. They're desperate because they know that's the only way they'll survive is to try to convince the world of the opposite of what we're all seeing. So that's why you see these desperate, pathetic influencers just spewing lies.
I'm here in Gaza and all I see is food, water, and opportunity. But instead of Hamas distributing the ramen noodles, they're eating it all, and that's why their leaders are on Ozempic.
Because that's all they have left. They don't have anything anymore. But it's too late. We're never going to forget what it looks like when Palestinians hold their children in plastic bags. No one can forget that. I'm never going to forget the sound of a drone emitting a crying baby so it can massacre children who come out of their homes. And get lured like a cat and mouse. No one's going to forget that. No one's going to forget what it looks like in Gaza today. You can't wash that away. You can't paper over that with degenerate propaganda, base level lies. No one's going to paper over the unvarnished truth of what we've all witnessed for years now.
That was journalist Abby Martin, creator of the Empire Files. The video is available on the Double Down News YouTube channel. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Thomas O'Rourke, and myself, Polina Vasilyev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Polina Vasilyev. Thanks for listening.